Psalm 37, verses 1 to 11. Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your justice as the noonday. Be still before the Lord, and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, it tends only to evil. For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace. Here ends the lesson. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
This is sermon number 3, hopefully of 4, about the Beatitudes. And as you've heard before, that's a strange word in English as well as in German, Beatitude or Seligpreisung. So that many people don't know what it means, whether inside of the church or out on the street. In fact, when I was a child hearing these verses for the first time, I thought beatitude meant the way your attitudes are supposed to be, or the way you are supposed to behave. Now, it's not a bad idea to read this text as an instruction about how to think and behave. But the word beatitude is not related to the English word attitude, which has a double T. It actually comes from the Latin beati, which means blessed. And that's the first word that begins each of these verses in the Latin translation of the Bible. Now, I'd like to just briefly review what we talked about in the last two sermons, which were nearly a year ago. In the first sermon, we looked at what it means to be poor in spirit and to hunger and thirst for righteousness. In the second sermon, we talked about the peacemakers who will be called sons of God, and we looked at the pure in heart who will see God. And I focused on two broad categories in those two sermons. Firstly, how does Jesus quote or allude to the Old Testament in these Beatitudes? And secondly, how does he live them out himself in his own life and in his own ministry? The points of application that I highlighted involved what I like to call thought experiments. And I suggested, for example, that you observe yourself around your friends and colleagues, and that you take notice of which people cause you to act like a different person, and which people help you to be who you are, simply who you are. In other words, which people help you to be pure in heart. Now, if you have been trying out any of these thought experiments, please tell me afterwards what the result was, whether it worked and whether it didn't work. I'm very interested to hear some of your input and feedback. And also, as an aside, someone asked me an excellent question at the end of the Revelation sermon on the first Sunday of Advent. And the question was, why do the kings hate the beast? And I gave an answer off the top of my head, and I now have a better answer. So if that was you who asked me that question, come find me again afterwards, and I'll give you the better answer. So let's read these Beatitudes together. Matthew chapter 5, we'll start with verse 3. We'll read the same way we did before. I will read the beginning of each verse, and you will respond with the second phrase of each verse. When we get to the end of the passage, I will read the entirety of verse 11, and you will respond with the entirety of verse 12. So here's verse 3, reading responsively. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Father, thank you for these difficult, challenging words. Please open our hearts again so that we may hear what you have to speak to us, and may every person in this room, and including myself, leave here filled with new inspiration, with new wisdom, and challenged to live for you, for your will, by your Spirit, in your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen. This morning I've chosen the meek and the merciful. Now, I have often heard Christians rather jokingly say something along the lines of, well, I've been praying to God to give me more patience, but instead he gave me a bunch of long lines to wait in and a bunch more difficult people to deal with. And I think there's something true in that sentiment. I started preparing this series of sermons about a year ago, and in the course of my preparations, of course, wanted to pray for understanding of what it means to be meek and understanding of how to receive mercy and how to show mercy. And since beginning to pray along those lines, I have found myself in one absolutely impossible situation after another, situations that threatened to rip every bit of mercy out of my heart and to exchange my meekness for bitterness and hatred and anger. And so God has really been teaching me, or trying to teach me, or show me the meaning of meekness and mercy in a very intense way. And I've been considering maybe in the future when I prepare a sermon, maybe it's a better idea if I don't tell God what I will preach about until afterwards. So the first beatitude for this morning: blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. If you listen to the reading from Psalm 37, you notice that Jesus is actually quoting David almost word for word. David says, "The meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." That Psalm, number 37, by the way, could be perhaps subtitled, "A Meek Person's Guide to the Universe." There are many instructions in that Psalm. Do not fret. Do not be envious. Cease from anger. Instead, trust God. Commit yourself to him. Rest in him. Wait patiently for him. Now, these words of David and of Christ are profoundly counterintuitive. They go gegen den Strich. Because if we look into the history books of any nation on earth, or if we open up a newspaper for any country in the world, we will find actually quite the opposite of what the scripture says. It is, in fact, not the meek who inherit the earth. It is the warriors and the conquerors, the emperors and the czars, the kings, the queens, the presidents and the prime ministers. It is the people who win wars and take captives and establish colonies who inherit the earth. And in fact, the meek people are more likely to end up in poverty or even in chains. This beatitude seems not to be true. This beatitude seems not to fit reality as we perceive it. But we remember, as we said last time, it is not the scripture that is upside down, but in fact, it is we who are upside down. It is our vision of the world and our experience of a world torn by sin, which is not the way it's meant to be. It's upside down. And when Jesus comes with his first sermon, the Beatitudes, He begins by saying, no, 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 let's turn your vision right side up again. Let me remind you by quoting from the Old Testament ancient truths that show the world as it was designed to be. The world right side up, the reality of the kingdom. And in that world, in that reality, in the hierarchy of heaven, it is indeed the meek who will inherit the earth. Now, we inherit the earth because the earth belongs to God. Psalm 50, verse 12, God says, "The world is mine and all of its fullness." And because God is our Father, we also, all things also belong to us. He is king. We are his sons and daughters. In other words, we are his Erben, his royal heirs. And therefore, we possess everything that he possesses. In Romans 8, verse 16, Paul says, "The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ." Paul repeats this same idea again and again in the letters to the Corinthians. With beautiful language, he says, "For all things are yours." For all things are yours, whether the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours, and you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. It's a beautiful truth. And it's not about material possessions or worldly wealth, of course. The poorest man on the planet who loves Jesus is a prince in the kingdom of heaven. And that poor man will inherit the earth. And all things belong to that poor man. In another place in Corinthians, Paul says, speaks of saints as having nothing and yet possessing all things. So we inherit the earth as children and heirs of the King of the universe. Now, if we understand this truth, we have the centeredness to be meek, even though we are living in a world based on struggle and politics and warfare and violence and oppression. I loved the song we sang just before the sermon. I'd never heard it before, but it really spoke to this theme. We're living in a world broken and torn by war and oppression. How can we live as meek people? How can we trust that we will inherit the earth? Now, being meek does not mean letting people walk all over you. Being meek does not mean saying, "Well, I'm not a very important person. My opinion doesn't matter. What happens to me doesn't matter." Being meek does not mean being a Weichei, as we say in German, or as a professor of mine, an old-fashioned professor of mine used to say in America, being a milquetoast. So meekness has nothing to do with breakfast food, in other words. No, being meek means living this truth, acting out this truth that we will inherit all things. Because if I know that I will inherit the earth as a child of God, if I know and am convinced that all things are mine and I am Christ's and Christ is God's, then it enables me to be meek. Because it means I do not have to strive and struggle to build my own kingdom or to establish my own reputation. It means I do not have to insist on my own way. I do not have to fight my way to the top. In fact, if I know deep inside of my gut that I will inherit the earth and that I will possess all things, then I can be meek. And sometimes being meek means being willing to lay down my rights or even lay down my life. Now, there's a catch here. There's a rub. Because there is a time to be meek, but there is also a time to fight. There's a time to lay down your rights, but there is also a time to insist upon your rights. There is a time to be silent, and there is a time in a loud voice to speak truth. Now, Jesus did both. There were times when he if I can use good American English, there were times when he really laid into the scribes and Pharisees and cussed them out, saying, "Woe to you, hypocrites, fools, sons of hell, brood of vipers, blind guides, full of dead men's bones and filth." Or, for example, in John, the second chapter, when he makes a whip and drives the merchants out of the temple, screaming, "My house shall be a house of prayer and not a den of thieves." He was not being meek in either of those moments. Of course, there were other times when such harsh words would have been appropriate, but he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. For example, when Pontius Pilate, looking face to face at Jesus, says, "Well, what is truth?" And there stands truth personified, die Verkörperung der Wahrheit, and Jesus does not open his mouth. And the meekest hour in all of human history was when Jesus hung upon the cross. The Pharisees mocked him mercilessly, saying, "Go ahead, holler for help from heaven, and see if anyone hears you, if you really are the Son of God." And Jesus could have done that. If Jesus had summoned angels, they would have come to rescue him. If he had called Moses or Elijah, they would have appeared in blazing glory. If he had commanded the earth beneath the feet of those men to swallow them up, it would have been so for all men to see and fear. But he didn't. He also could have done something else. He could have laid into the Pharisees again and cussed them out. He could have read their thoughts aloud and recited their sins one by one in front of everyone. But he didn't. He was meek. He held his peace when he would have been justified to speak harsh words. Now here comes the connection to inheriting the earth. If Jesus had not known that he was the heir or the Erbe of all the earth, he never could have suffered the cross. If he had not known that he would be the firstborn from the dead, if he had not known that he would ascend into heaven as the first fruit, with many thousands of us following behind, he never could have kept silence in the face of injustice and hatred and violence. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. You must know, as Christ did, deep inside of your gut, that you will inherit the earth, and that all things do belong to you as a child of the King. Or it's impossible to be meek. It is this greater knowledge, this truth that is deeper than any injustice, that enables us to be meek in the right moment, to cease striving, and even to fall silent in the presence of our enemies. Now, I have a problem here, because I want to tell you the secret. I want to tell you steps 1, 2, and 3 of how to discern when to be meek and when not to be meek. But I actually do not know this yet. I've been working on it for quite a while, but I have not figured it out. Just recently, in one of those impossibly difficult situations I mentioned, I chose to be meek. I could have spoken harsh words, but I chose to be meek and to be mild in my speech and not to lay into the people who deserved it. And afterwards, my boss came to me and said, "Michael, that was very admirable. But what you could have said, what you should have said as the leader of this group is," and he gave me a very intense example of what would be appropriate for me to say in that situation. And so since that experience, almost every day and every night in my mind, this situation plays over and over again like a video on repeat, with different versions of the things I could have said or should have said. Or maybe I really should have been meek, or maybe I should have done half and half, first harsh words and then meekness at the end, or maybe sort of a meekness sandwich, meekness and then angry words and then meekness to round things off at the end. So I say very honestly, I am still learning and trying to figure this out. I'd love for those of you who are also in leadership positions at your work or in the church to give me your input and your insight afterwards, because I think you know this type of experience and you know this dilemma. Now, even though I can't tell you the ABC of how to discern this, what I can say is that it's important to remember there is no default. So it's not as though I can say, well, be meek 100% of the time and then you're safe. Or say the woe is you and make the whip 100% of the time and then it's good. There is no default answer or no paushal answer. So it's important that in each of these situations we lean upon the wisdom of God. And what I'm trying to do in myself is to get really good at two-second prayers. So when I see this situation arising, I have to say to myself, all things are mine and I am Christ's and Christ is God's. Just to reestablish that I will inherit the earth, I am promised to inherit the earth, all things are mine, I do not have to defend my rights. I do not have to fight and struggle my way to the top because I already inherit all things. And with that truth refreshed or brought freshly to mind, then I lean upon the wisdom of God, whether it is right to be meek at that moment or whether it is right to speak a harsh, true word. So those of you in leadership, please do come to me afterwards and help. Give me your insight. Now the next beatitude, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Also in this beatitude, Jesus is quoting or paraphrasing from the Old Testament, also from a psalm of David. In Psalm 18, David says of God, with the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. So again, in the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he's not making up new things. He is pulling all sorts of beautiful, powerful truth from the Old Testament and saying, look, remember, this is the world right side up. This is reality. Now let's talk about mercy for a moment. I was traveling with Deutsche Bahn a couple of weeks ago, and I was invited to a wedding in another city. And I wasn't sure how long the wedding would be, so before I went to the wedding, I purchased the return ticket, the last ticket of the day, just to be safe. But the wedding was shorter than I thought, so I was able to get an earlier return trip. I noticed on my telephone that the price of the earlier trip was 10 euros more expensive. It was a small town train station with no staff, and so I thought, okay, I'll wait till I get on the train and then I'll just pay the extra 10 euros and then everything will be fine. So I'm sitting on the high-speed train and the woman comes by to check my ticket, and I said, I bought a later connection, the wedding was done earlier, so I'll just pay you the 10 euros if that's all right. So she punches around on her machine for a while and she says, yes, you may pay the difference and that will be 74 euros, please. And I thought, I misunderstood her. I said, come again, wie bitte? She said, 74 euros. And I said, I don't understand. On my phone it said there's a 10 euro difference and there was no one in the train station to help me. And can you, I'd like to just pay the 10 euros. And she said, no. She explained, your ticket is on a phone. Even if you had someone to help you at the train station, they can't change what you've already booked. And so you need to pay 74 euros. So I was, of course, very disheartened and frustrated. I said, okay, I don't have this in my budget. And so if it's okay, I would get off at the next stop and just wait for my original connection. She said, that's fine, but you have to pay for now until that next stop to get off. So I feel like I'm sinking deeper and deeper into the Deutsche Bahn. And so I said, okay, well, please tell me how much that will be. And it's a high-speed train, so the stops are far apart. But she thought for a minute and she said, you know, don't worry about it. Just get off at the next stop and then we'll call it a deal. So fine. So she moves on checking the next people. First thing I do is pull out my phone to text the person I was planning to meet at my end destination to say I will be 2.5 hours late because this blöde Kuh is forcing me to pay 74 euros and ruining my day and ruining my trip, and now she's going to make me sit in a cold train station in the middle of nowhere and wait for 2.5 hours. What a terrible person. Everything's awful. Now, before I clicked send, I remembered something. I thought, in my luggage somewhere is a voucher for a first-class upgrade. I got it for free. I'm not sure how, but I thought maybe maybe I can bargain with her a little bit when she comes back by. So when she came back, I said, listen, I really want to stay on this train, but I don't want to pay 74 euros. Can I give you this voucher for first class upgrade? And maybe you can count that as the ticket that I should have bought. And she looked at the voucher and said, no, this doesn't work. That's a first class upgrade. You need a ticket for the high speed train. So I shrugged my shoulders. I gave up. I said, all right. And I began to pack my things together. But she stood there for a minute. She didn't continue on. She just stood and I could tell she was thinking. And she said, you know what? Just stay. Stay on the train. And I was so relieved and so grateful. I don't know why she's decided to change her mind, but she said, you can stay and you go all the way to your end destination. And of course, I was so grateful and I promised I would never do it again. And thank you so much. And thank you, thank you, thank you. And yeah. So she showed me mercy. Now, of course, this is a relatively trivial situation. This is not one of those impossible situations I was telling you about. It's a trivial situation. But nevertheless, I immediately recognized that God was trying to teach me a lesson in mercy, using something as silly as having booked the wrong train ticket. So when I realized that, I immediately went into thought experiment mode, and I began to observe my mind and my heart, how I was responding to not receiving mercy and then to receiving mercy from this woman on the train. Now, before I received mercy, I assumed that the staff would go along with my plan. I assumed I would get on the train and say, here's what happened, here are my 10 euros, have a nice day. I assumed they would just all go along with my plan, with my rules. But when I did not receive mercy, I was angry. I claimed to be innocent, and I started listing my merits. I wasn't trying to trick Deutsche Bahn. I was at a wedding. There was no one. I kept listing the reasons why I deserved to receive this mercy. And then when she didn't give it to me, I began to speak badly about her character. This blöde Kuh is making me wait in the train station. Of course, I didn't send that message. I erased it afterwards, by the way. And also, I completely ignored the mercy that she did show me. I should have paid her for station A to station B, even though I couldn't get all the way to where I wanted to go. She offered me that short trip for free. I completely ignored that small mercy because it wasn't the mercy I wanted. I wanted a different mercy, and so I stayed upset. And finally, I started bargaining. I wanted to offer her a deal. Maybe if I can convince her or catch her eye or catch her interest somehow, then maybe she'll start finally going along with my master plan. Now, when I did receive mercy, I, of course, was very grateful. In fact, more grateful than I would have been if the trip had gone as planned. But my gratitude quickly gave way when she finally continued on. My gratitude gave way to 1,000 different sorts of thoughts. And in my thought experiment, I observed all these thoughts and started to write them down as if I were a psychologist observing myself. I noticed when I saw the woman again, when I wanted to use the restroom, I felt ashamed and embarrassed. In fact, I almost thought, well, I'll just wait to use the bathroom till I get there. I was ashamed to walk by her because she had shown me mercy. I was ashamed that I was in her debt, so to speak. Also, I was afraid if I see her again, maybe she'll change her mind. Maybe she'll say, you know what? And I was also afraid that maybe she might be thinking badly about me. That guy was not telling me the truth. There was no wedding. He was planning that scheme all along and pretending to be so kind and airless. He was just taking advantage of me. I also noticed, on the one hand, I worried she might make me earn that mercy somehow. And on the other hand, I wished I could earn it so that I wouldn't be in her debt anymore. I wanted to offer her a gift, maybe one of my cookies or a clever joke or maybe a free ticket to the opera. Something, anything, so that I could get out of debt. I wanted to keep promising her I would never do it again, and I wanted to somehow convince her that I was indeed a noble and worthy candidate, a deserving candidate for her mercy. And then finally, I started asking myself, but why did she show me mercy? What was it about me that made her want to show me mercy? Did she like my sweater? Did she like my glasses? Did she like my accent when I speak German. What was it about me that caused her to show me mercy? Now, of course, it's, as I said, this is a very silly example, but how often do we respond to the mercy of God the way that I responded to the simple mercy of a worker on a train in the Deutsche Bahn? How often does that happen? Just like on the train, don't we often make plans and expect God to go along with them and bless them? You know, God, just so you know, here's what's going to happen, and I need you, your blessing at points A, B, and C. And when we don't receive the mercy we want from God, maybe when he doesn't go along with our plans, don't we get angry at God? How could you do this to me, God? What about all of the good things I've done for you? What did I ever do to deserve this? We've all prayed it. And don't we sometimes try to bargain with God? Well, okay, God, if you show me the mercy I really want, if you do it just for me this one time, I promise I'll read through the Bible every day this year, and I'll pray, and I'll start working in Sunday school, and I'll be a good person. And don't we often forget, when we're looking for this big mercy, don't we often forget the daily mercies that are new every morning, that we woke up, that our hearts are beating, that we have freedom? We forget those mercies because we're not getting the thing we really want in that moment from God. And just as on the train, when we do receive mercy, how often is our gratitude mixed with a thousand other thoughts and concerns? I hope God doesn't think badly of me. I hope God isn't standing at the top of the stairs, crossing his arms, raising his eyebrow, and tapping his foot, waiting for me to get it together. I hope that God isn't saying, "But this is the last time, and I mean it. No more mercy." And I hope that God doesn't change his mind. I hope that he doesn't regret showing me mercy and decide to condemn me at the last minute instead. And don't we always ask ourselves, "But why me? Why should I receive the mercy of God? Was it because I'm a nice person? Was it because I've done so many good deeds in the past? Was it because I gave money to the church and taught the children? Why did he show me mercy? What was it about me that made him show me mercy?" And the wonderful, confusing thing is that there is no answer to this question, because there is no reason for the mercy of God. There is nothing inside of us that makes him say, "Oh, wow, I'm impressed. You get mercy today." There is nothing inside of us that causes him to show us mercy. We cannot earn his mercy. Mercy, by definition, cannot be earned. And if I can give a sort of umgangssprachliche definition of mercy, I would say mercy is when someone important bends the rules for your sake and there's nothing you can do to earn it. That's what happened at the cross. God bent the rules for your sake and for mine. That was our cross. That was my cross. I deserved to be there, because I have broken the laws of heaven. Now, this is the truth that keeps many people outside of the church. They don't want to admit that that is my cross, which I deserve. I belong there, not Jesus. But God bent the rules for my sake. He bent down and crawled into a virgin's womb and was born a human being with flesh and blood and bones and a beating heart. And he lived the kind of life that we should have been living all along, according to heaven's law. And at the end, he died the kind of death that we all deserved, because we broke heaven's laws. And in his death, he broke the power of sin in our hearts. And when he rose from the dead, he broke the power of death in our lives. Someone important bent the rules for our sakes, and there's nothing we can do to earn that or to deserve it. Now, when it comes to mercy, we often think about being a good person or a bad person. Maybe good people get mercy or should get mercy and bad people shouldn't. But mercy and good people, bad people, those categories don't fit together. They don't intersect. They don't match. It would be like if I took a scale in kilograms outside and tried to measure the temperature of the weather. It doesn't matter how precise my scale is. I can never measure degrees with a scale in kilograms. They're the wrong categories. They don't fit. It's the same way with mercy and being a good or a bad person. It doesn't matter if you're a good person. And it doesn't matter if you're a bad person when it comes to mercy. God shows mercy to the good people and the bad people alike. I remember I was about 16 or 17 years old the first time I began to think of myself as a bad person, because I grew up in the church and I was a fairly good boy. And I still remember where I was. It was a Friday night worship service. I remember where I was sitting in my home church. I remember the musicians who were playing. And all of a sudden, this word mercy fell on me with a weight I had never experienced before. And I realized, I'm not a good person. I can't deserve the mercy of God. It's impossible. And from that point on, I've begun to think of myself, well, maybe I am a bad person. And then that thought develops further, and I think, well, if I'm a bad person, there's no way I could get the mercy of God. God could never show me mercy. Maybe I'll slip away and slip outside the mercy of God. But this is the good news. Those categories don't fit. If you are a good person, you can't be good enough to earn the mercy of God. He gives you his mercy. And if you are a bad person, you can't be bad enough that his mercy doesn't reach you or doesn't apply anymore. I say it again because this is so important, and I've been learning it my whole life, trying to learn it. If you are a good person, you can't be good enough to earn the mercy of God. He gives it to you freely. And if you are a bad person, it doesn't matter how bad you are. You cannot be beyond the reach of the mercy of God. He gives it to you freely. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. And in his cross with his hands outstretched, he offers mercy to the good people and the bad people alike. I am so grateful for that. Now, in the first beatitude, the meek inheriting the earth, you noticed I flipped it around. I said, we will inherit the earth, and out of that knowledge, I am enabled to be meek. And with this beatitude, I also want to flip it around. If we read it forwards, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy, it's easy for us to understand it as legalism. In other words, well, if I show mercy, if I pay mercy into my account, then I can receive mercy. I can get mercy out of my account when I need it. But that's a legalistic system. Mercy is not a currency. It doesn't work like that. So to help myself understand this, I flipped it around and I say, it helps me to recognize that being merciful to other people is rooted in the knowledge that we have freely received the mercy of God. The root is we have received such great mercy. And the fruit of the tree is blessed are the merciful. Now, if a tree doesn't bear fruit, there are a few simple reasons for that. Maybe it's an immature tree. If you plant a fruit tree, it needs a few years and a few seasons before it's ready to bear fruit. Or if a tree doesn't bear fruit, maybe it's sick. There's some disease deep inside of the root system that prevents it from bearing fruit. Or perhaps it's actually not a fruit tree as you thought. Maybe it's just a thorn bush. So I ask you to ask yourself, this is the thought experiment part. Are you a merciful person? Do you show mercy? And if not, then why? Is it because you're an immature Christian and you don't have the practice in showing mercy? Is it because your faith is ill? Is there some disease or sickness in your faith that inhibits you from showing mercy, even though you're a mature Christian? Or are you not a fruit tree yet? Are you not a good tree? Do you look at yourself and say, I actually don't know the mercy of God. I don't understand it, or maybe I don't think I need it. Ask yourself these challenging questions when it comes to receiving the mercy of God and then out of that overflow, showing mercy to others. Now, in closing, I'll just summarize some of the other points of application I've mentioned. If you are in a leadership position, remember there's a time to be meek and there's a time to pull out the whip and say, woe is you. And practice that two-second prayer. All things are mine and I am Christ's and Christ is God's. All things are mine and I am Christ's and Christ is God's. Say it with me one time. All things are mine and I am Christ's and Christ is God's. Practice that two-second prayer just to reestablish, I will inherit the earth. I'm centered. I'm grounded. I don't have to struggle and fight. I'm grounded. And I will lean on the wisdom of God to know whether to choose meekness or to choose to fight. And continue also the thought experiment of observing yourself in various situations that relate to mercy. Observe how you respond. Compare how you respond to the mercy of men to how you respond to the mercy of God. Just observe yourself and take note of your thoughts. And above all, practice receiving mercy. Stop trying to earn it. Stop trying to figure out what is it about me that makes God like me. There is no answer to that. God shows us mercy because he is merciful. There's nothing in us. Stop trying to earn it. Stop trying to find the logic or reason of his mercy. Just receive his mercy. Let it wash over you. And then let his mercy wash through you. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Amen.